So Roger Bannister, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm sure when you broke the four-minute barrier 55 years ago, did you ever imagine that you'd be pestered by people like myself for the rest of your life, wanting you to talk about it?
No, certainly not. But, of course, it was 9 years since the world record had been set up by the Swedes during the war. They weren't involved in the war. And so I realized it was something of importance, but I didn't think it would continue to be rated as highly.
I'm sure not. Now, you've had a brilliant life both as an athlete and as a neurologist, and I believe you've worked extensively on a thing called autonomic failure. When you look back on your life, do you feel sad that you're going to be maybe remembered more for the athletics than for your medical prowess?
Well, I suppose it's given to most of us not to be remembered for anything, so I should be grateful. But in my own mind, of course, my 40-year neurological career and my family are far more important than the four-minute mile, which I did as a student, I was 25 when I qualified as a doctor and at the same time retired from competitive sport.
Now, I see that. So if we take you back to 1954, I believe on that day you nearly didn't run because the conditions looked like they were going to be against you actually being close to breaking the world record. How close were you to not actually running?
Very close. When I woke up that day, the weather forecast was bad, and I knew that I could, under ideal conditions, break the four-minute mile, but windy conditions mean that it's impossible to run efficiently, and I would have had to do the equivalent of a 3:56 mile on a good day in order to break 4 minutes. And if I had attempted it and failed, then my own confidence would have been, I think, impaired for my next attempt. And by the time I had my next attempt, John Landy might well have been in Finland, and given ideal conditions there, he might have broken it first, which was not what I wanted.
I'm sure it wasn't. Now, just also, how important were the sort of efforts of Chris Brasher and also Sir Chris Chataway?
Very important. There is no race, world record race, that has been broken without some early pacemaking. There are one or two instances, Clark and Elliott possibly, who could have done the thing with what we'd call front running. But it's very, very unusual. And you don't get many middle distance records in world championships or Olympic Games. The style of having to pace yourself evenly is not really consistent with being certain to win a highly competitive race. These other races are usually won by a sprint at the end. One runner has had a little more in reserve and can manage to sprint, which of course itself destroys the even pacedness of the running. So Chris Brasher, they were long-term friends. He set the half mile at a good pace, and then Chris Chataway took over in the third lap. The only problem with the pacing was that in the third lap, as always happens, the pace got slow, and so it was over 3 minutes at the three quarters, and I had to do the last lap in 59 seconds, and I wasn't quite sure I could do that.
Well, history will show that you actually did manage to do that. Now, you mentioned John Landy, and obviously we've actually had him on this show, and he talked about the race that you two had later in August in 1954, because he broke your time in the sub-4-minute mile eventually, and then you raced the Miracle Mile. Now, when he came on the show, he mentioned how what cost him that race was looking over his left shoulder, and in the meantime, you came round on his right-hand shoulder and beat him to the punch. How do you remember that race?
Well, that race was probably the most important in my career, because had I broken the 4-minute mile, he then took the record. If I had lost to John Landy, then there was absolutely no doubt that John Landy was the supreme miler in the world. So it was important. He probably was stronger than I was. He had trained harder than I had, and he had run more 4.2 second miles than I had. So he was, in fact, the favourite, and possibly we were still on austerity diets in England, and maybe you were better fed in Australia too. So I wasn't the favourite, but I knew that John Landy didn't really have as good a finish as I had. So I was counting on him setting the pace, which would have been fine for me, was fine for me, and in order to focus his attention on having to set the pace, my last race in England, I ran the last quarter mile in 53 seconds or something of that kind to indicate the power of the finish. So he did plan the race to race me off my feet. He very nearly did. He was leading by about 12 yards at half a mile, and I had to climb back painfully to get to his shoulder by the bell, and then he did try to get away on the back straight, and I think he looked over his shoulder because he realized he was nearly finished, couldn't accelerate, and wanted to confirm that he had in fact dropped me. But unfortunately for him, he hadn't dropped me, and that was the moment when I went round to the right-hand shoulder. The element of surprise was something that I'd been taught by great runners in the past. Jack Lovelock, for example, the New Zealander, Oxford Rhodes Scholar and Doctor, who won the 1500 metres in the Berlin Olympics.
Right, and how important as well was Franz Stampfl, your coach, or were you not teamed up with him at that stage?
No, very important. I hadn't had a coach until the last year, but he was the coach to Chris Brasher and Chris Chataway. And so it made sense to weld us together as a team. And that was when I started to go to sessions that he held at the Duke of York's barracks in London. And we used to meet, I think it was on a Thursday night, and we would discuss what we'd been doing in training. We'd run together a series of fast and slow quarter miles, and then go and have tea afterwards in what were then called the Joe Lyons Tea House on the corner of Sloane Square.
Oh, and I've heard of the place. I do know it. Now, one thing you mentioned there about the big races and obviously how world record times aren't run there, I was surprised to read that you were invited to be part of the possible squad for the 48 Olympics, but you actually declined that. Now, that interested me as to why you did that, but also I heard that you saved some blushes for the organisers with regards to the Union Jack. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that.
The reason I withdrew, I was only capable of doing the equivalent of about a 4.8 mile. I knew that wasn't good enough to win a medal, and there was a lot of talk at that time about runners burning themselves out, getting stale. I was 19, and I think it was nonsense, really. I could have run, and if I had run, I might have got some good experience, which might have led to my not making such a hash of the final of the 1500 metres in Helsinki in 52 when I only came fourth. But there we are. That was a decision taken. I don't regret it or repine particularly. And it did give me an insight into how the Olympics were organized. The incident that you mentioned was that for some curious reason, they were an austerity Olympics, and we didn't seem to have an English flag at the time of the team marching into the opening ceremony parade. I don't know quite why, and there was a flag that I knew was in the car, back of the car of the commandant of the team. And so my job was to get back, find the car in a car park with, I suppose, 50,000 other cars, get into the car by breaking a window, and then I had an army assistant with a jeep, and he got me back to the opening ceremony in time for me to give the flag to the British team, and that was enabled them to march without embarrassment. If you notice the film, you'll find that the British flag is smaller than the others, and I gave it to Don Finlay. He was group captain Finlay. He had been in the 36 Olympics as a hurdler, and then came back after the war and was still a member of the team, probably the most experienced and senior.
That's a fantastic story. Now, you mentioned there, obviously, the 52 games where you came fourth, but the thing that was amazing was the times that everybody ran in that race. I think there were seven people ran under a four-minute mile, and it was one of the fastest...
Oh, excuse me, not under a four-minute mile in 52.
Sorry, no, not under...
Yes. They broke... They ran faster than the previous Berlin...
That's right, yep.
...Olympic title. But it was not a four-minute mile repeat pace.
No, you're right. Sorry, thanks for correcting me. Yeah, but it was seven runners, I think, beat the Olympic record.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it was won by Jozy Bartel, who happened to be a very hard European runner. And in my own mind, what was the decision that made me not able to win was running three races in 3 days, which I hadn't prepared for, and with a last-minute introduction by the Finnish organisers, not at all necessary. Previously, there were heats and then a day's rest and a final, and as it happens, that, what I would regard as a mistake, has never been made again. There's always been a day's rest before the final of 1,500 metres, which is out of recognition of the fact that it is a particularly exhausting race, in that it's an equal mix between anaerobic capacity and aerobic capacity. That's what makes it difficult.
No, it certainly does. Now, I believe that you were forced to stop running back in 1975, but you've actually managed to start running again because you managed to find some special shoes that have helped you.
Yes, I had this car accident and a crash. The car ran into us head-on and wasn't my fault, but I jolly nearly died, I suppose, so I was lucky to be alive. And the ankle was crushed. But what I've discovered in the last 6 months is that the Kenyans have developed shoes for reasons of economy which are cut out of car tires. And these shoes enable you to roll without putting a strain on the ankle. So that's why I'm jogging a bit.
Well, that's remarkable. I mean, because I think, if you don't mind me saying so, sir, you're in your 80s or 80 years old now, so it's phenomenal that you're still getting out there and able to run.
Yes, well, I don't run as fast as Chataway does.
Well, it's good to hear that you've still got the competitive spirit in you. Just finally, sir, I mean, there's talk that if you're alive, that you would maybe be asked to light the flame at the Olympics in 2012 in London. Would you regard that as one of the greatest honours you could have?
Well, I think there are a lot of other people more qualified than me to do it. Obviously a great honour for whomever is chosen.
No, I'm sure it would be. Well, Sir Roger, we thank you very much for sharing your very precious time with us today, and we wish you all the very best, and again, thank you very much for your time.
Well, you're welcome. Give my best friend in Australia, John Landy, my greetings. I hope he's healthy and well, and his wife and children. I've got a great affection for Australia. I first remember, of course,